Okay, so first of all then, the network itself, we were formally established in a drinking pact in September of last year. Some of us within the history department have been attending events as part of another network, an intoxication network that was funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. And we were struck by how productive the conversations were at various events that they'd organised between scholars from different disciplines working on all different aspects of intoxicants and intoxication. And we had kind of a core of Warwick historians who were attending all of these events, and that made us think perhaps we might be able to kind of have a critical mass of scholars at Warwick working on aspects of drinking. Perhaps we could have a Warwick-based network of our own. And we were aware of people, a handful of people in other departments that we knew might be interested. So we organised a symposium in September of last year and brought various people together. So since then, in the last kind of 8 to 10 months, we've really been on our kind of first phase, I suppose, has been a recruitment drive to try and discover people at Warwick working on pretty much any aspect of drinking and drinking cultures in either from the past to the present day and across a number of different disciplines, trying to flush out, if you like, people who might well be interested and have something to say to other people interested in drinking. And this recruitment drive has been very successful. We've now got over 30 members in the network from a wide range of disciplines, as you can see. Our core of historians that we started with, we've had lots of people from sociology, classics, psychology, law, and we started to get people interested now from the medical school and from biological sciences and other disciplines as well. So we've got a very nice spread. And people not just from Warwick, but from beyond Warwick as well. We've now got members from Canada, California, Florida, and the Netherlands as well. So we've attracted quite a wide range of interest in quite a short space of time, which is fantastic. Anybody here who isn't a member of the network that would be interested, then simply send me an email. I'm Mark, and my contact details are on the front of your handout. Send me an email. I can add you to our list on our website and give you emails about all our upcoming events. Phase one has been trying to get recruitment, and it's very successful. We've got some good numbers now. Now we're trying to sort of think about moving on to the next stage and trying to think about what kind of outputs we might actually be able to produce as a network. What can we brought people together to talk, but what can we kind of get from those conversations? We had thought initially that collaborative research project bids might be something we would do, which could still be a possibility, but in terms of kind of the numbers in the network now, any kind of collective research project I think would just be unwieldy. But we're hoping that the network might perhaps provide a framework within which smaller groups of people might be able to identify others that they might want to do collaborative research projects within, and the network would kind of help to facilitate that. In terms of thinking about outputs, at the discussions that we've had so far at our symposium, and we had an IAS-sponsored speculative lunch a few months back as well, was that we wanted to kind of try and focus on particular themes within that crop up regularly within different disciplines on drinking and drinking cultures. Issues such as regulation, something that people across different disciplines are interested in. Age and gender are common themes that seem to come up across disciplines as well. So we thought in terms of, by focusing on specific themes and trying to get different scholarly perspectives from different disciplines on those themes, might be one way in which we could kind of direct our conversations towards kind of reaching some sorts of conclusions. So with that in mind, this next symposium in September, which we're intending to hold an annual drinking studies symposium each September. This year the intention is to focus on a particular theme, which will be drink and the life cycle. So we're trying to encourage people to think about the relationship, not just between young people and drinking, which obviously is a very kind of prominent theme that we found, but also different age groups in drinking, or how drink interacts at different stages of the life cycle with life cycle celebrations and so on. So the intention there is to take that one particular theme and try and get people to come to it from different angles and see where that takes us. Matt circulated a call for papers for that upcoming event in September. The deadline for that was going to be tomorrow, but given that for some of you that looks to be quite short notice, if anybody is interested in putting forward a paper for that proposal, we're still open to paper proposals within the next couple of weeks. We'd still be interested to hear your ideas. So what we want to do with this symposium and going forward is think about what kind of outputs we might have from having these conversations on particular themes. So whether there may be some scope for publications coming from the conference, or conference proceedings perhaps, podcasts as well. As you now know, we're doing a podcast of today's event, where that might be another thing that we think about with the symposium. And also we're kind of hoping to develop really towards next summer holding a much larger conference, perhaps over over a couple of days. Under the banner at the moment, we're thinking a banner of biographies of drink, which we're hoping will kind of be an organising theme that we're going to develop. And with this conference, we're hoping to really kind of get everybody who's interested in the network to come along and speak on their own research, but also to try and kind of tie it in around some central themes. We're also going to try and think about how we might have kind of innovative outputs from that larger conference. So again, publications, proceedings perhaps. We're also thinking in terms of perhaps having roundtable discussions which might be written up as essays, which we might try and kind of disseminate. And part of the thinking behind this larger conference is to try and think about how we might kind of go from talking to each other to trying to kind of branch out and have some kind of public engagement from the conversations that we have. So we're thinking, trying to think about ways in which the network might may well perhaps provide a platform from which academics can try to contribute to public debates about drinking in the present by drawing on our different perspectives from our different disciplines and different time periods and so on. So it's really with that that kind of principle in mind of trying to get together to discuss certain themes and then trying to think about how we might contribute to broader public debates as a consequence of that, that kind of leads on to the second part of what we wanted to do with this evening's session, which was to try and take one of those, take a theme and get people's different perspectives on it, try and kind of have some discussion and debate around that theme. And Matt's going to introduce that for us in a minute. But I thought what might be useful before that would be as if we could just go around and briefly, if people can say who they are, what department they're from, and just very briefly one or two lines on what their interest is in attending the session here this evening. Okay, so I'll start us off. I'm Mark Hillwood. I've done a PhD in the history department here, and I'm interested in ale houses and their role in facilitating drinking culture in 17th century England.
I knew you'd come this way. I'm Steve Bates. I'm a second year PhD here at the University of Warwick, and I'm looking at the English Reformation, and I'm predominantly interested here in the formation of culture and identity and how religion and conversation, religious conversations might take place in our houses and how that may input into my work.
I'm Fiona Colligan. I manage the Wilson Research Exchange and run these sessions, facilitate these sessions for you. And I'm also the one that's provided the wine tonight, so.
Welcome.
I'm Marianne Cullen. I'm a senior research fellow in CEDAR over on the Westwood campus. And my interest is we've been evaluating parenting programmes, one of which had a particular aim to reduce young people's drinking and drug taking. So I was just interested in that aspect because it was growing parents and young people at the same time.
I'm Lee Gunn. I'm a research fellow in health and social studies, working on work with families and also with a particular interest in families and mental health issues with overlaps with addiction.
Yeah, William, I'm a clinical lecturer at the in public health at Warwick Medical School, and alcohol is one of the biggest public health issues currently, so I'm just here to get a grasp on that.
I'm Kate Meeks, I'm from the Classics Department and I'm doing a PhD. I study Athenian vase painting, so I'm interested predominantly in the use and form of the material culture surrounding drinking, particularly in Athens, the taverns and domestic contexts.
My name's Will Brummel. I'm a history PhD student. I study South African imperial and colonial history, but I mean, in terms of my interest here, is that the drinking of history and that social culture provides a kind of comparative methodology for looking at informal relationships. So it's a sort of a shared similar approach, but with different analytical aims, I suppose.
I'm Rebecca Earle. I'm also from the history department, and I'm a cultural historian of Spanish America, and I've lately been interested in the meanings of food and consumption in the colonial period, and so I'm interested in alcohol as one element of that.
I'm Bjorn from education department. I'm studying math education, but I'm just interested in culture in all aspects.
Yeah. I'm Bill Cumin. I'm one of the early modernists in the history department, with a particular interest in German-speaking Europe and the public houses in comparative perspective, particularly their political functions.
Tom Fernall-Reed, currently teaching sociology at Coventry University. Previously I did my PhD in the sociology department here at Warwick. One of my main research interests is the links between alcohol, drinking, masculinity, sexuality, friendship, and this all came out of my doctoral PhD research, which was with British stag tourists in Krakow, Poland.
Yeah, my name is Dieter Wolke. I'm a professor in developmental psychology in the psychology department. We have done or do research on drinking and pregnancy effects on children, and one of the controversial findings is that you do worse if you're teetotal as a kid than if you had a little nipple, the mother had a little bit of drinking. If it's too much, it's not good.
Well, a little bit is good.
A little bit is good. 1 to 2 units a week, and they've got less behavior problems, less hyperactivity, higher IQ. So.
Wait,
hold
on.
Duly noted.
I'm Michael Moore. I'm a social psychologist currently visiting at the psychology department on campus, but I'm based in Israel, and there I was the co-author of many studies on drinking patterns by young people. Where do they get the drink? Whom do they drink with? What are the religious and ethnic differences in for a wide range of groups.
Hi, I'm Luana Baldwin. To be honest, my research is very far removed from this. I'm researching patriotic education in Russia. But I came out of curiosity to see what a drinking studies network would be about. So, honest.
I'm Dave Hitchcock. I'm also from the Department of History here, my second year, PhD. And I study vagrancy and mobility in England. But anecdotally, that means I'm also interested in alehouses because they could be a space, effectively a space where we can find the mobile poor. So I comment from that angle.
I'm Kirsty Lohman. I'm in the sociology department at Warwick. I do a PhD in punk culture in the Netherlands, which involves both a lot of drinking, but also groups that are straight-edge punks who abstain from drinking and the tensions between those two.
I'm Ruth Cherrington, a former member of staff at Warwick. I used to work in the Centre for Translation and Comparative Cultural Studies. My interest in working men's clubs goes back to my childhood because I practically grew up in one. But joking aside, I think it's true what you say about a little bit of a tipple for youngsters. Apparently I had a little bit of stout in my dummy for a number of years, so you see, good result. joking aside, working men's clubs have been a key part of working class leisure for over 100 years. In fact, the movement is nearly 150 years old, and yet there's hardly been anything written about them. I think they're a neglected area of study, and they're often misunderstood. So I'm focusing on the community roles and the identity roles that clubs play. So my catchphrase is always, it's not just beer and bingo. Yes, there is beer. Yes, there is bingo. But there's a lot of other things going on in clubs. So I want to document these while the movement is actually in decline. So I think it's quite important that someone does that.
Hi, I'm Matthew Jackson, first year PhD student in the history department.
looking at drink and identity in early modern England and France, looking at drinking house practices and how people employ a drinking house space to formulate identity in a number of fields. And I pursue this through a comparative case study of two early modern maritime cities, Bristol and Bordeaux. So that's me in a nutshell. So let's get to the theme of this today, I suppose. So I'd like to talk briefly about the background to this event and what drew us to open the debate and invite all of your insights on the question of alcohol as something more than just a problem. I think it would be fair to state that academic attention to alcohol has tended to fall under two predominant, though not independently exclusive, remits of research. On the one hand, social and cultural approaches to drink that emphasise the cultural meanings, motivations and variations in patterns of drinking behaviours, and medical and neurological approaches emphasising the intoxicating effects of alcohol on mental processes and the human body on the other. In terms of governmental attention to drink, both today and in a historical perspective, official attitudes have generally gravitated towards the latter approach, employing it to stress the dangers that drinking, and particularly excessive drinking, pose to the individual and to society as a whole. An examination of these negative discourses, past and present, is informative in many ways, but particularly in revealing the degree of continuity they maintain throughout time. Legislative practice sought and continually seeks to control the timing of consumption, the standards and activities of retail outlets, the quality and strength of drink available, in the hope of reducing the problems associated with drinking too much. Examples include the early 17th century statutes against the odious and loathsome sin of drunkenness, the Gin Act of the mid-18th century, the energetic temperance movements of the late 19th century, and most recently the 2003 Licensing Act, which paradoxically extended drinking hours to restrict the sudden rush to the bar before closing time. Continuities also extend to the representations of alcohol and its consumers. In modern and pre-modern societies, drink was, and still is, seen as interfering with work patterns, destabilising a country's industriousness and draining upon public resources. Alcohol is typically described as the source to acts of violence, both within the home and in public, as well as the stimulant to shameful, mindless and irrational behaviour. On your handout, on the little pamphlet there, on page 2 is Thomas Hayward's 1635 pamphlet on drunkenness, offering quite a fabulous illustration of a man's irrational and explicitly bestial degeneration following a few drinks. Well, quite a few in this instance. On page 3, unfortunately the photocopy machine really let me down here, so I'm going to I'll try and describe what is perhaps impossible to get from those images. But basically there are two snapshots of, top one is binge drinking boy and the bottom one is binge drinking girl. And these are two characters from the recent 2008 Home Office televised campaign against excessive drinking. You can view the videos on YouTube and the links are there if you'd like to see them. And the videos basically show the characters destroying their clothes and vomiting and urinating on themselves before leaving the house. And the videos end with the slogan, "You wouldn't start a night like this, so why end it that way?" And it's, again, this kind of tangential link between the messages conveyed in the modern campaign and its historical precedence in Thomas Hayward's kind of bestial degeneration. Conceptions of gender and age in relation to drink hold similarities too. Hogarth's graphic depiction of Gin Lane, with debauched and drunken women sprawled out on the streets of London, might seemingly be paralleled with the modern media concerns surrounding female binge drinking and its connections to a rise in unsafe sexual practices. On age, young adolescents are and have been continuously earmarked as the most excessive and alcohol experimental of a society's drinking population, for example, while stereotypes of elderly drinkers as foolish, red-nosed wastrels pertain since time immemorial. Our intention here, of course, is not to suggest that policies controlling and attitudes towards alcohol can be fixed in chronological unity, but that we can nonetheless discern a common thread. That people continue to drink, and often drink excessively, in spite of the social and moral condemnation, as well as the state efforts that seek to limit access to alcohol and dictate the ways in which it should be consumed. Viewed in this sense, then, one begins to question whether, underneath these negative discourses, there remains a more positive range of values and experiences to be gained from drinking, which continually motivate individuals and groups to participate in this practice in the face of potential risks loaded to it. Asking this question is basically the theme and motivation for our meeting today. So I'd like to kind of open it to you guys now and ask kind of how your own research and academic experience might shed light on the kind of positive functions of alcohol or, you know, or otherwise.
I'll kick off. Looking back at the 19th century, which is where I will actually begin before that, but working men's clubs got going then. So I read a lot about pubs and drinking practices, and it seems there are quite a lot of contradictions amongst the ruling class of this country about the role of drink in society, and perhaps some that they didn't quite understand, that in some ways drink oiled the wheels and the mechanisms of capitalism, because I refer to Brad Beaven's idea of the culture of consolation, that life was tough, life was bleak, homes were poor and rotten and stinky and smelly, but there was a pub to go to. So, hey-ho, people carried on going to work because they had that consolation aspect of drinking, which perhaps the ruling classes didn't really take on board enough. So that's one point. Also, drinking is rebellion. The fact that maybe we can't overthrow society and can't overthrow the powers that be, but you can go out and get drunk and make a little bit of trouble and you know, create a stink and upset people. So there's that idea as well, and I think that came out a lot with some of the protests against the temperance reformers, the way that some temperance people used to go into pubs and try to claim the lost souls of drinkers, and sometimes the drinkers actually went to the Salvation Army places and tried to reclaim them back. And you know, sing the hymns as pub songs. So I think there's quite a lot of complexity. That's what struck me looking at this area, going back in history. And I think we've inherited that. And I think that's why things like the drinking regulation of the latest one, 2003, the idea was perhaps to curtail drinking, particularly that last minute rush, but it's actually extended it. And I think it still shows that authorities don't really quite know what the role of drink is, particularly to, I say, the lower class of the working classes. And so there's a lot of unmuddling to be done at levels, and I think that a network like this, with people getting together from different places, looking at different aspects of drinking cultures, certainly can help to unmuddle some of that. That's what I'm expecting, isn't it?
The one thing that emerges strongly from sort of a historical view at all these drinking issues, that is, often drinking is seen as a very positive accompaniment of social ritual and social interaction. So, yes, there's this sort of despair, perhaps, element, the rebellious element, but it's also one that marks any kind of coming together, any kind of things you do in society, as it were, or in company. And I think that's a very sort of positive feature that people almost cannot do things like marrying or baptizing children or concluding a business deal without formally marking it with a drink. And that sort of you know, positive association of alcohol as something that creates, I think, is an interesting aspect that I particularly try to sort of highlight.
And following on from that, I mean, alcohol is spatially acceptable in certain areas and utterly unacceptable in others. So mass, drinking the blood of Christ, which is of course red wine, is utterly different from drinking out of a paper bag on the street, right? Even if what you're drinking out of a paper bag is red wine. And there's been, I think, an interesting, and I don't know, maybe it's increasing over time, you tell me, separation of the places wherein and the times wherein one does or does not drink. So of course there's the tippling laws in early modern England, which I'm familiar with, and there's certainly a changing story of the alehouse that, you know, we can tell you over time, when you go to it, when you don't. There's also, I think, a time-based, you know, you drink at different times based on what it is that the drinking is associated with. But I'd be curious what people who are more sort of well-conversed in modern sort of regulations and practices of drinking would have to say about the acceptable and unacceptable locations where you will find drink.
I think an important thing is something no one would discuss about drinking if there wouldn't be problem drinkers. I mean, I think that's the major thing that people do talk about alcohol, because otherwise it wouldn't be something you would particularly discuss. And in psychology, it's quite well known that you drink more if you're depressed or anxious, because it releases anxiety. You see, you relax when you drink. You talk to other people. If you're introverted, it helps you actually to become more extroverted, to go out. And if you look at different societies, going from Finland down to the south, you find different patterns of drinking. I mean, Britain, look at it as well, more reserved. You have got more drinking to actually socialize with other people. You don't need that much in Italy, because you can socialize with people immediately. You know, you don't need to have a drink for this. And therefore, you have got less alcoholism problems, because you don't need to reduce tension which you have. So if you look at it from a historical perspective, you must not forget the differences in different cultures and how they're actually organized and how much you need to reduce tension, that you actually socialize, you're open with other people. And if you come to youth, one of the things is, one of the tasks of youth is that you become from a non-sexual being to a sexual being, yeah, that you can reproduce. And one of the things that happens is that you drink to get access to the other sex, or the same sex as it may be, to actually raise relationships. So what you need is to relax people into actually being able to do. And that's a high time where you drink hell of a lot. So I would actually urge you not just look at spage, look at biology, look at population genetics, look at factors which actually have to do with drinking and what it does physiologically that then regulates because your social interactions.
And you'd say you can apply those insights fairly easily to historical scenarios as well, because presumably those effects don't differ all that much over vast swaths of time, or...
Well, I haven't done research in it, so I can't say. But there will be there are differences. I mean, from population genetics and things, they're different. But there are also cultural differences, of course, how you socialize, and it has to do also how you introduce alcohol. I mean, it's in France or Germany, others, you do drink at 11 or 12 when you have got a meal together, and it's actually shown. The earlier, if it's not a taboo subject and you introduce it early but controlled. And with the parents' knowledge, rather than hiding it and drinking behind and you get it enforced, you actually drink much more responsibly.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that's particularly interesting about having some sort of interdisciplinary gathering. The extent to which, and what one regards as the starting point for analysis, because I think when you were saying Italian culture is more relaxed, and you can see this in a different drinking pattern, which sort of, you know, empirically makes sense if one goes to Italy and thinks, oh, okay, these people are all more relaxed. But actually, how does one measure that? How does one determine that? What is, you know, what is the, and does one regard the physiological behavior as the thing that doesn't vary across time and space? Or does one imagine that actually physiological responses too can somehow be subject to cultural forces? I mean, that's... And I think it would be interesting to hear about the extent to which people working in different disciplines answer that question in different ways. To what extent is the physiological response to alcohol something unvarying? I don't know. Who's from psychology? Yeah? So would you say that this is... I mean, is that... I think probably not so much. I don't know.
Not research area so much in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
What you are saying, it's more... It's a physiological question, and it's also a historical question. Are we drinking the same as things as the Romans did? How did they water their wine, which they did heavily, and all the hard liquor that we are drinking now, was that available in historical times to the same extent? And price ranges are. Was it only the accessible to the rich? Many questions. I don't think psychology has an answer to that.
Because I thought that there was a good deal of evidence that was suggesting that actually people's responses to alcohol contained a substantial learned element.
That's not physiological.
To people, and then they give no alcohol to people and tell them that they're giving them alcohol, and they act as if they're very drunk.
Oh, yes.
So,
Yeah, there's some is learned, but there is actually the genetic evidence. And one of the things is the resistance to drinking. And you can best study that, for example, in Japan, because you find in Japan parts of the population, you've got certain genes. I mean, you can see if they drink just one glass of alcohol, they get mottled, they get red, they feel sick, they have to leave. And what you find is actually what happens, society is then you have got different genetic, people have got a different resistance to alcohol. Some can drink a lot and some can drink a little. But society decides what happens to them. The ones who can drink very little have got a very low risk, because if you get sick quickly and so on, you've got a very low risk to become an alcoholic because you're not liking to drink. But if you can drink quite a lot, in particular if you're in our current society, let's say here in Britain, if you can drink a lot, you get a very high peer status because you can drink them under the table. I mean, you're, you know, pretty much something in the social group. So that encourages to drink more, but after some time you get sick because you become an alcoholic, and that has then negative physiological things. So the genetics actually underline whether, I mean, the ones who can't have got a high resistance to alcohol are very unlikely to become alcoholics. But the ones who are high resistance to alcohol can drink a lot. It depends on the society and how what reinforcement they get, the learning, whether they will become alcoholic, how highly they're valued in society, basically.
Look, I think like the cultural norms, again, kick in, as you say, because, you know, amongst, I keep banging on about the working classes, but not just the working classes, but this general idea that to drink is good, not to drink is bad, and that, you know, to be able to drink a lot, yeah, you get high status amongst your peers, particularly in the past amongst men, but increasingly now amongst women. And yet, traditionally, there have been limits, you know, even amongst working class cultures, there's an idea that you don't go over a certain level, that it's great being drunk and having a laugh, but you know, there's a line that it's not very clear, but it's there, a boundary. And if people went beyond that and became drunks, and then it became socially unacceptable. So there's quite a lot of pressure on you to drink to a certain level and to have fun and a laugh and have a joke, but not to go beyond certain ones that you impoverished yourself and you made a fool of yourself. And now I've been quite interested in that because, as I said, the boundaries are very unclear and they change over time and they do vary from region to region. You know, even within England, there are different levels. But certainly that kicks in to sort of control even excessive drinking behaviour to stop people becoming alcoholics.
I guess one thing we shouldn't forget is how much resources that alcohol generates, you know, for societies through taxation, fiscal appropriation, and simply jobs. You know, jobs and services and livelihoods, etc. So alcohol is a very sort of tangible economic benefit for people who, you know, make a living out of producing and selling alcohol, and obviously that has to be balanced against the social costs, but there's certainly a big sort of fiscal and economic benefit that the alcohol industry has had ever since it started.
Sorry, just saying, I won't say anything else with this, but just to pick up on that again, I think it's undervalued, it's not recognised that when a pub closes, as we know, there are about 50 pubs closing every week, and probably about the same number of clubs closing every week as well. It's jobs gone, and it's local support for that. You know, they not only employ local people, there's the breweries and all sorts of knock-ons. So this is a big loss, not only to the community, but it's an economic loss, and I think that this is something else that needs to be considered and taken a bit more seriously.
The last two actually interest me. Looking at it, how whether it's actually there's a social benefit, I mean a financial benefit to alcohol, I mean per se. At the long run, I mean the cost of it in terms of health, in terms of the social
money.
Destruction,
money,
and all those things coming around, we still have to pay for them. So, well, I don't know. I don't know about any studies that have compared the cost to the financial benefit of it. Mm-hmm. But I will have a lot of doubt as to whether there is a net gain.
Well, it creates jobs in the health service. Then go straight from the pub, retrain, go in the health zone. No, but the costs are higher than, for example, tobacco-related. Like, for example, death, mortality, and morbidity is higher related to alcohol than, for example, tobacco. To just have an idea, and you can see how strong the campaign is tobacco-related and how strong it is related to alcohol. I think it's much stronger for tobacco. It's a taboo, you know. I mean, sitting here and having a smoke, but if I would get a glass of wine, you wouldn't throw me out. So it's
more about social acceptability than because of alcohol somehow.
Yeah.
It's food. It's much more difficult to legislate against food or to, you know, look down on somebody who is eating or drinking than just smoking. You know, you don't have to smoke, but you need to eat and drink.
Is that not suggestive of the success of those different policies, though, that perhaps because the campaign is so good against tobacco, it's reduced the cost to society?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it is reducing, I mean, with smoking, but I mean, it's plateaued, I think. I mean, because still a lot of people, I don't know how many, smoke 27% or something, or 30% of the population. It's also the social strata is all the same as it's for alcohol. The interesting thing is just that when we did a review for the health, for the Department of Health, they had a group on alcohol to report on it. It was about alcohol and pregnancy. That's how we got in the research. The brilliant thing is that in Britain, a lot of women drink. I mean, middle-class women drink. They come home after work, have a glass of wine, or sit down, and so on. So they're fantastic to study because they don't have any other social problems. They're not poor, you know, they're not unemployed and so on. And the problem was that all alcohol studies that have been done of the terrible effects are terribly confounded because they're poverty, they often take other drugs, they're unemployed and so on. So you don't know whether it's alcohol, they smoke. Yeah. So you don't know whether it was alcohol that has an effect. But studying actually middle class people who are in jobs, don't have social deprivation and so on, and drink. Yeah, occasionally and sometimes more, also binge drinking at a party or ball or whatever, you can actually study the effects without the social negative effects. And when we did this in pregnancy, we found it doesn't have, light drinking didn't have on the babies a negative effect. I mean, we follow them now till 7 years of age, and still it's a slightly positive effect. So it's important that you have to rule out all of the other social, other confounders that could explain why it has such a negative effect.
I'm quite interested in where these boundaries are set as well as to... there's a sense that from what you're saying that there's an ideal where we can have people drinking responsibly and therefore still have the economic benefits without the economic disasters. And is that policed by a government or by kind of self-appointed moral governance, or is it by peer? I'll have your keys, you're not driving tonight, and so on, or sticking another pint in front of your mate because you think he's funny because he's already drunk, or whatever it might be. So I think there's certain pressures which people respond to in determining how much they drink and what they think is sensible, and I think that's quite an interesting. It's more than a dialogue, isn't it? There's a number of voices in that.
I found that with my research that in clubs there's the idea that young men learn to drink responsibly because they're in the presence of older generations, and you know, they learn traditions about buying around, standing around, and you know, there was excessive drinking, I won't deny that, but it was less so than these days when kids are off on their own, which is good with the kids, and drinking alone and binge drinking. You know, I think the idea that, again, goes back to the social setting, if particularly intergenerational groups, tends to be some sort of control, and the idea that you learn to drink properly, so you learn to take your drink like a man or a woman, but you don't go beyond the boundaries, and it's seen as a social act and not an individual act. And I think probably comparing classes, it's probably the communal aspect of drinking in places like clubs and pubs is different to drinking home alone after work and sloshing about a bottle. and which is quite hidden, and I think we're only just beginning to recognise that now as a problem, and not just focusing on the pubs and the clubs as a problem.
I guess there's a cultural shift, isn't there, with the kind of availability of cheap alcohol from Tesco, and that of course feeds into what you're saying about pubs and clubs closing down. Because it's significantly cheaper to have my friends over with a six pack than it is to go down to the pub. Now, whether the environment is more convivial is another discussion, but I think that's something that would feed it.
Come to every single person I've asked, interviewed over the last 4 years, that always comes up cheap supermarket booze is a bit of a killer. Added to that, smoking ban, so at least you can stay at home, get cheap drink, and you can smoke. And that just keep a lot of people at home now, stops them going out to pubs and clubs. So.
Anecdotally, the price of alcohol in this country is exceedingly cheap to compare it to places like North America.
The major supermarkets sell lager, beer, cheaper than water.
Yeah.
So, in terms of units, and obviously that's something that the governments are looking at, but there's a bit of a scary future. The governments don't want to upset the big four supermarkets too much, do they?
There seems to be an assumption in some of what was said earlier on that excessive drinking and alcoholism are the same thing. Is that the case?
No. Not necessarily.
It's interesting how, the idea that the kind of the learnt or respectable drinking is always kind of a moderate drinking that stays within certain parameters. But in fact, I think sometimes part of the culture is the kind of the excess, the loss of control, of really kind of not overstepping the unspoken boundary of getting too drunk, can often be that line can be quite far gone. It's not necessarily about moderate consumption, and I think excessive alcohol is actually part of that. It's sometimes seen as part of the positive culture, the excessive consumption. I think we shouldn't always assume that particularly excessive consumption of alcohol is kind of that's uniquely a problem, and as long as people drink moderately, then it's kind of socially okay. But that, there's some social and cultural appeal to actually kind of really pushing the boundaries towards excess, I think, within drinking culture. That's something that needs to be considered as well.
I mean, it's partly a question of what moderation means, right, which goes back to the questions that were being raised earlier about the locations, the timing, the context of acceptable drinking. I mean, there's certainly, as you know, there's lots of evidence from a variety of cultures, of indigenous cultures in Spanish America, so historically, that the concept of moderation was associated with when you drank, but that when you drank to get drunk. And that was what was intended, and that there were all sorts of benefits, exactly as you were saying, that were seen as sort of opening yourself up to the divine and to allowing a kind of communion. But that you weren't supposed to with the dead, for example. But you weren't supposed to be, if you did this every day, this would be seen as completely immoderate and inappropriate, but in its right setting.
I mean, we can all easily construct scenarios where the acceptable level of drinking would be far above what we would consider moderate. So you're at a stag party with your best mates, and one of your friends is about to get married, or a hen party. The level of drinking that will be implied by that activity is significantly higher than going to the pub every other Friday.
Also more acceptable in that
and
context.
More acceptable within that group, within that unit. So there is a sort of a cultural explanation for various levels of consumption. I think I think there's physiological and medical value to appreciating those things, because you can look at those practices and quite precisely identify when, mm-hmm. where, and why someone is going to get more drunk and possibly do more harm to themselves.
That's one of the reasons they bring certain derby football matches forward to a silly time in the morning, isn't it?
I think social policy, state policy already has a certain appreciation for that. But perhaps a little bit more would be in order, I don't know.
But isn't it that cultures have always allowed... I mean, it's quite interesting when people analyse Catholic cultures, which are very restrictive, much more restrictive than Protestants, but you do find that's where you find carnival. Yeah, I mean, you go, for example, Germany, I've got carnival. I mean, they get very, very drunk doing their things, because what you do is, if you're suppressed all the time along and you have to be good and you go to the church and all of these things, then there need to be periods of time where you have to let your hair down, because
I mean, even the bishops said, I mean, if you put them down all the time, I mean, you won't have anyone who will follow you anymore, so you have to give time, a valve where you keep... And that's what you're talking about as well. I think it's in every culture that you've got the valves where it's perfectly okay that you can get drunk on this because everyone does. It's a celebration, but then you're okay again.
Is there perhaps something more to say than kind of abusing alcohol as a way to release and forget and escape from a system, as opposed to something which can actually bring a lot of people together, you know, in a much more positive sense? Because I think when you frame it as something where you escape, it tends to gravitate towards these kind of negative discourse that people...
Well, but it brings you together as well, because, I mean, you know, like in Brazil or whatever, you dance and you party and so on, it brings people together.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, but I suppose it doesn't even have to reach that kind of excessive stage, does it? There's that whole build-up to it. I mean, in terms of the stuff I look at, you know, in terms of 1550, 1750, this is kind of before blood tests. So the way people are thinking about what was too much is so culturally defined that it really becomes negative when... Well, it's difficult to pinpoint when it's negative, when something bad occurs from it, but really it stays positive for a very long time. I just wonder whether,
but it in some sense in that period it's also about control. So the kind of what seems to be the exalted kind of cultural model is that you drink as much as you possibly can while still staying in control of your physical capacities or your reason. So there is still a kind of a dimension. Well,
yeah.
There is a cut-off point, sure, where it crosses that line into unacceptable, but I think it's so much more blurred than as now, when perhaps you can do a blood test and someone, or a breathalyzer test, and someone say you are too drunk, you are excessively drunk.
No.
So perhaps that's the reason why it becomes easier to attach a negative label to it, because it can be clearly defined.
But no one does that. I mean, if your son or daughter comes home, I mean, you don't do a blood test. I mean, you can see whether they crawl in or can talk to you, can walk down a straight line. Or if you're at a party, you know someone, there's no one coming up and does a blood test. You take the person out and say it's time to go home or something. I mean, it's the same. I mean, that is only the police. That's the official control. But all of the other control is totally socially and what you see and observe.
I think, you know, the way that these negative terms have entered our language, I mean, you use yourself, you know, alcohol abuse and excessively drunk and so on. I mean, if you take a breathalyzer, you're over a limit, that's just the limit that is set, as you say. But we have these negative terms, and where do they come from? They come from powers that be, from moralizers or whatever. And then, of course, these days we've mediated so quickly that they're thrown around without really being looked at to see what do we mean by that. Because it's true that certain people, certain cultures, can go and drink quite a lot on a regular basis and yet still lead a full life and still keep a job going and still raise kids, etc. So
I think there's also a periodic raising of concern. It's not a sort of a permanent sort of, as it were, social... worry, alcohol. It tends to come in certain particular moments in time. You know, historically, maybe the Reformation is one of these big moments when people get terribly worried about the impact of drinking, and we seem to be in another of these moments. The Enlightenment in the 18th century was another big moment where one thought one shouldn't waste productive time by drinking. So I think there are interesting sort of waves of public concern and public relaxation about it as well, and we seem to be in a moment where there's a lot of concern, which isn't necessarily, I think, reflective of the actual level of consumption, because they historically have been quite high, much higher, I guess, than what they are today.
Isn't there a very strong association with violence, and that's a pick up on your social costs and health costs? Coming from Scotland, the hard drinking culture, I mean, the association with the violence is really, really strong there. And also, you know, like domestic violence at home, rigid murders. I mean, being in an accident emergency unit on a Friday night in Glasgow is a fairly scary place to be. So I think that, you know, I mean, one of the things that I've really gained from being this opportunity, I really thank you for putting it on, is just listening to the different perspectives all around, what a complex topic it is.
you know, from my perspective, thinking about these parenting programs and, you know, as a society, how do we within the family socialise our children into, you know, drinking and also drugs, which are related, but this is particularly about drinking. And what the, you know, the one of the programmes, the Strengthen Families programme, 10 to 14, one of its aims was to reduce negative use of alcohol and drugs. And when we talked to parents in interviews, they were sort of raising the issue that alcohol's more than just a problem. That's partly what drew me to this. You know, it's just, it is such a complex topic and it has so many social meanings, and yet, you know, as you say, such strong, it can have such negative health implications and social implications. It's really one of these things that's really difficult, I think, to encapsulate in a short parenting programme. So it's,
I think, I mean, related to that is the issue then of how, when alcohol is a problem, how do you actually deal with it and approach it? And understanding the complexities of its appeal and why it's so kind of such a persistent and central part of culture is important, because no one's going to effectively tackle problem drinking without actually, if it's just simply defined in very negative terms, because you won't have a proper understanding of what it is you're trying to tackle.
Yeah.
So I think whether, with this, with part of this broader debate, whether people are thinking in terms of how can we talk more positively about drinking, or if you're motivated by trying to control or tackle drinking as a problem, you still need to understand all those complexities. Seeing it starkly in negative terms is not helpful to people who are looking to target problem drinking any more than it is to people interested in positive aspects.
Yeah, that actually makes it different from maybe other. Somebody was comparing to smoking, for instance. That actually makes it different, because at least with smoking, you're not talking about a limit. People just know that it's bad, and people generally understand it that way. Unlike alcohol, you don't actually want to tell people to completely stop drinking.
Yeah.
No, you don't mind them drinking, but you want to define a limit, and which is very difficult to define in this case. So I suppose that debate would take longer. I mean, even with smoking, it took 50 years to overcome. So I will expect that with alcohol, it would take much longer if it is negative at all, if drinking is negative.
I say smoking, boys, so longer. I'm thinking of King James writing a famous tract about the evils of smoking at the beginning of the 17th century. But of course, people have been drinking wine since, you know, before history, probably. So before they learned to write, they were making wine, he said, facetiously. But, you know, I mean, how do you, if you take this as a kind of 4,000, 5,000-year history of fermenting fruit, etc., you know, I mean, how do we move away from that? But you're right, I mean, there's this one sense in which there's a limit with what is acceptable to one's biology, irrespective of any kind of moral or sociological issue. And then beyond that, of course, is the fact that physiologically there's such a breadth, which, I mean, you've touched on already, talking about people in Japan, that, you know, what is a good level for one person clearly isn't for another, and you can't legislate that. So how do you draw those lines?
Maybe it has persisted, because actually wine, you know that alcohol in low levels has got, in adults now, has got positive effects on preventing heart disease and strokes. But it is at really moderate or light drinking levels, it's positive. And this has been replicated now, whether it's been, first it was Chilean wine when it came out, Cabernet Sauvignon, so it was expensive stuff you had to drink, but now you can drink now with beer as well in Czechoslovakia. It has been replicated. So actually, I think it's something like Darwinistic or something has persisted, because actually it's not negative. You might live longer, you know, if you drink in moderation, but if you get to the severe thing, then you are that thing. And it may well be that if it's like inverted U curve, that if you're teetotal and you are unrelaxed and unhappy and so on, it might not work, might be negative as well, you know, so that you've got a U curve that's bit is not bad, and that's different from smoking.
A very interesting presentation of the last one by a fellow from the medical school, if I'm not mistaken. And he had a very interesting graph of, was it Italian consumption?
Yeah.
And I forget his daily metric, at the end of the day, but it was surprisingly high. Was it what, a glass and a half or something?
I think it's a bit more than that.
Yeah. There was no measurable difference between drinking a sip of wine a day or I think over a glass and a half medically, as far as he was showing. And I remember being significantly surprised by the vast gray area between a glass and a half of red wine and a sip of red wine, and the utter lack, at least as far as he had been showing, of a medical difference. So, I mean, that the gray area interests me, because we know what happens to people when they are, when they become alcoholics. We can, that's been studied and measured, right, to a certain extent. And we know what happens now with light drinking, and we know there may be detrimental effects to never drinking. But I'm interested, perhaps, or just very curious about that vast, uncharted middle ground. And, you know, how do you deal with that? I mean, because... I mean, we don't call binge drinkers alcoholics, but we know binge drinking is in and of itself problematic. So there's this huge gap there between those things.
I think that's why looking at history is going to be really helpful. That's why it's good that there's so many historians here, because you know, we can look back and see how people try to understand that middle ground in the 19th, 18th century, and before that. And look at the ways they tried to legislate and control, and you know, how they got it wrong, and to what extent they might have got it right as well. For example, with the clubs, the person who was very at the forefront of working men's clubs was a teetotal reverend, a Reverend Henry Solly, and he linked, you know, drinking to the violence and wife beating and men not having any money and not paying the rent, along with the temperance movement. And so he wanted clubs to be dry, to have no alcohol in them. But the working men wanted a drink, you know. They didn't want to get drunk every night, they just needed a drink. And, you know, a lot of the time drinking beer was about quenching a thirst. When you've been down a mine for 12 hours, or in a factory, or, you know, in any other really awful manufacturing industry, which is not very pleasant, having a drink is actually quite helpful in that sense. So, you know, the Reverend Solly had to realise that... you know, a certain level of drinking was good, was acceptable, and that you can't suddenly take that away from groups of people who is part of their culture and has been part of their culture since time immemorial. So, you know, he accepted that, and which was probably a good thing that he did. Otherwise, the club movement wouldn't have gone on. It would have folded, like a lot of other reform movements at the time that were trying to be set up as teetotal arrangements. So I think, you know, looking back and seeing how things were done will give us insights, and I wish that present-day politicians had that historical perspective and would look, you know, they are not the only ones dealing with drink and different behaviours around drink. You know, it's been looked at before.
Okay, well, we've been going for our hour now, and I suggest that perhaps we kind of... Draw to a conclusion, our more sort of formal debate. But of course, we have alcohol available at the back. Whether you've made a decision on whether it's a positive or a negative, you can either help yourself or not to a glass of wine for more formal discussion. I think there's been a few kind of key recurring themes that come out of the discussion. That, to me at least, there seems to be a number of dichotomies, if you like, which all seem to kind of overlap with each other. So in thinking about positive and negative aspects of alcohol consumption, thinking about differences between the physiological and the cultural aspects of drinking, this difference between moderation and excess, again, kind of interacts with whether these are positive or negative, or how much that moderation and excess are governed by physiological factors or cultural factors. And then also social cohesion and social problems are two distinctions, whether alcohol serves to actually bring people together, bind society together, or whether it actually serves to create social problems and domestic tension and so on. So I think we've kind of identified a number of different polarities, and in almost every case, of course, there's some kind of overlap and some kind of middle ground to be found. And obviously, hopefully through further discussions, we can perhaps develop those ideas and get closer to some conclusions, perhaps. So thanks everybody for coming along, and hopefully we'll see you all at future events. As we say, we have our symposium coming up in September, and we'll be continuing to have future events. And if you've found today illuminating, then please do stay in touch and stay involved, and we'll carry these conversations on further.